Hello, I'm Preston Schleinkofer. Welcome to Civil Defense Radio, where we discuss all things civil defense. What does that mean? Well, in a nutshell, it's about building community resiliency by becoming better informed, prepared, and organized to meet whatever disasters might affect you and your community. This week's show is brought to you by doTERRA's On Guard Beadlets and On Guard Plus Protective Blend Soft Gels. On Guard is a great way to strengthen and maintain a healthy immune system. This is why they are my family's daily regimen, especially during these colder months when it's a lot easier to get sick. The beadlets are just 1/4 of a drop of the blended essential oils that makes it so effective at doing its job. I carry a tube in my pocket for on-the-go use. The proprietary blend of oils in On Guard Plus soft gels have a great On Guard formula plus some extra oils for an added kick to boost your immune system. For more information, visit our website at Oils for Life Today. That's oils4lifetoday.com, or go directly to the link that's at the bottom of the show notes, and it'll take you straight to the On Guard products, which there are many. Now let's get on with our show. This week's episode is coming on the heels of the InfraGuard National Disaster Resilience Council Summit that was happening in D.C. this week. There was a lot of information, a lot of great topics, and speakers gave us some information that just blew us away. And again, we have Drew Bumbeck here with us, and he was there for the second day's event, and we're going to be talking about that. But before we get started, we're going to listen to an interview I did with Professor Adam Schultz, who's a geologist at the Oregon State University in Oregon. He's got some really, really fine things to say here. So let's listen to that real quick. All right, we're at the InfraGuard National Disaster Resiliency Council, and I'm here with Adam Schultz. He was our guest speaker the first day, and he's with Oregon State University. So, Adam, can you give us a brief bio of what brings you here and what you're looking at picking up, you know, taking back to Oregon with you?
Yeah, certainly happy to do that. I'm a professor of geophysics at Oregon State University, and I've been involved in InfraGuard and in the NERC Geomagnetic Disturbance Task Force for quite a few years. The background in all of this is we discovered, better part of 10 years ago, that a huge data set we were collecting for totally different reasons, fundamental scientific reasons, where we were systematically mapping the electrical structure of the United States in terms of its ground, crust, and mantle below ground level, turned out to be essential for understanding the risk to the power grid and other built infrastructure. So at that point, we started getting more and more involved in efforts to develop standards for grid protection, discuss this with regulators, and more or less to do this on the continental scale, both in the United States and Canada, because our two power grids are intertwined. Yeah. So this is where it all started, and it eventually got elevated to White House level, because this is also related to protecting the power grid and other critical infrastructure from electromagnetic pulse, which of course can be produced by artificial means as well as solar coronal mass ejections and all of that.
Okay.
So that's how we got here today. And, I keep in contact with a lot of people who are in the room here, and we have a very active dialogue on a whole bunch of levels as we try to, over time, come up with cost-effective means of reducing risk to really all aspects of our society, because everything depends on that continuous service of the power grid. And when things go out on a large scale, we end up with potentially catastrophic disruptions to all aspects of our society.
Yes, it's amazing the number of people that are here at this summit, and I mean we've got military officers. I think the highest one is a former 3-star, and we've got professors like yourself and engineers and people from the power industry. We've got people from the regulatory industry. I met some people yesterday from the NRC. You know, this is quite an event with a lot of interest and a lot of people with some real knowledge about this this issue, huh?
Yeah, no, it's been gratifying because it's also crossed political and administration boundaries. I mean, there's been complete continuity from the last administration to this one, which is very, very gratifying to see. It keeps getting elevated to really high level. I mean, at the end of the day, when people turn the light switch on, they kind of want power, and they take it for granted. You know, I live out in you know, rural Oregon, and you know, we have a well, and if the power goes out, there's no water, right? There's nothing. Most people can't afford to harden their personal infrastructure to make it resilient to that kind of situation. So they depend on those utilities just working. And the risks are real, right? And the risks are not not inconsequential. We live in a natural electromagnetic environment, and when the power grid was first designed, it kind of evolved 120 years ago from a simple need to provide power without any thought of all of this funny stuff going on in the space environment, or you know, people launching satellites with warheads or what have you. So our grid, being more or less the oldest one in the world, needs to be rethought a little bit, and people are aware of that.
And it's the largest one in the world, too, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
at least for now.
For now, and it does span, you know, the continent. And so, what happens, you know, up in Ottawa actually matters to New York or Boston, because that power is moving across national boundaries too.
Yeah.
And fortunately, it is being looked at on that continental scale. I mean, there are organizations that are helping advise the regulatory environment that cross over that national boundary.
So do we have part of our grid go down into Mexico, northern Mexico as well, or does it stop at the river?
Well, actually, yeah, it is truly continental scale, so there isn't a hard boundary. And my understanding, this is sort of secondhand knowledge, is, in fact, the interconnection of grids is happening through South America as well, and at some point we're going to see the entire hemisphere lit up in one interconnected circuit, for better or worse.
Well, then we better get on the stick and make sure that everything's secure so people continue to have power.
That's right.
Exactly. I know Venezuela's having a lot of problem keeping their lights on, and we don't want to be like Venezuela, or unfortunately California's having a problem with the rolling blackouts too now.
Exactly.
For now, they are.
And, you know, you think about fires are a threat to the power grid, and that can be kind of localized, but, you know, you have cyber threats as well.
Yeah.
And then you start thinking, well, what about the interplay between all of these threats, where you could have a cyber attack along with an EMP attack or a space weather event? Uh-huh. You know, and it gets even more complicated, because if there's a huge, you know, ejection of charged particles from the sun and the Earth is in the wrong place in its orbit at the wrong time, you could also have a disruption to communications in the satellite networks that are used as backup communications. So then you've got these multiple threat levels that have to be managed at a time when you may have an impaired ability to communicate and move equipment.
Now, since you're a specialist in the ground effects of electromagnetic disturbances, I can you describe a little bit how that works? Where when let's say a coronal mass ejection happens and it bounces off the infrastructure underneath what we normally believe is the ground,
right?
But it's much deeper down there. Like in Virginia, we've got some some very solid rock that's below us. So what happens when that when there's an electromagnetic situation
sure.
with that,
in fact,
rock?
In fact, Virginia and I'd say the Appalachian and also the Piedmont region turns out to be one of the more challenging ones because of this. And we've discovered this through our other work. I mean, basically what's happening is you're setting up an electrical circuit actually above the atmosphere in the Earth's ionosphere and magnetosphere, and electric currents flow because these charged particles from the sun will interact with the Earth's magnetic field, and these charged particles will get captured to an extent and start circulating above the atmosphere. That couples into the Earth below through this physical process called electromagnetic induction. And it's how electrical transformers work, actually. You have a loop of wire and current flows through it, and you've got another loop of wire separated from it, and current flows in that in response to that. And that's what's happening in the Earth below. And it turns out that the upper 200 to 300 miles of the Earth's outer surface matters in this process for the power grid. And the property we worry about is the electrical conductivity of the geological materials that make up the Earth. And it turns out we've discovered through this continental scale mapping effort I've been doing for the last 13 or 14 years that everywhere we look at every depth under the Earth's surface, there are huge variations in the electrical conductivity of these materials at every scale. And so while previously people thought of ground as kind of this infinitely big bucket you can throw electrons into, it turns out it has a finite capacity to absorb those electrons. It has this property of conductivity that leads to a property called the impedance. And if that, you know, impedance varies from one place to another, it actually affects the electrical circuit that is the power grid, because the power grid is grounded. And so the problem there is the complexity of all this, the complexity of the power grid's electrical circuit, the fact that it's changing with time constantly, because you can imagine during the day, the loads vary. People come home from work, they turn stuff on, generators come on and offline. Parts of the grid may go out for maintenance, or there may be failures, and so the circuit is constantly being adjusted. And you have thousands of operators out there providing power, all interacting with each other. So the complexity is kind of mind-boggling. And then you've got this problem that everywhere you look under a power transmission line, this property of the Earth, the impedance, is different. And so you have, say, a magnetic field coming in from space, and it's interacting through this electromagnetic induction process with all these different impedances along the power line. So one event from the sun may have a different response at a given point in the power system than another event from the sun, while the circuit is also changing. So you can imagine how difficult this is to understand and to manage dynamically, but that's exactly what we're trying to do right now. So it's a huge job. When you get down to the consumer end, you have a distribution system that feeds off the transmission system. Right now, we're focusing on the long-haul transmission system.
Yeah. Great. Well, it looks like we're going to get started here, so it was great talking with you, and thank you very much.
A pleasure. Thanks.
All right. Well, that was great. Hey, Drew, I want to bring you in now, and let's get your take on some of the things that Professor Schultz has said here.
Well, you know, I think it's interesting to hear him talk about the project of mapping and how important that is for hardening the grid, for critical infrastructure reliability and strengthening and security. And it's also interesting to hear that, you know, things really vary across the country. I mean, we kind of knew that, and you kind of expect it, because, you know, you've got geology varies across the country, but hearing that, and also hearing what he says about, you know, Virginia being kind of problematic, makes me kind of cringe and go, well, maybe I should move. it's really good though to get that information right from the source, the person who really ran with this project. So,
yeah, he spoke to us on the first day, and it was very interesting. And I wasn't able to get to him the first day, but I got to him in the early hours on the second day, when before this second day had kicked off, and we had a chance to talk, which I'm very, very pleased that we were able to do that. He's a neat guy, and you know, some of you may remember that I'm originally from Oregon, grew up in Portland, so it's nice to know that Oregon is being represented in this effort to learn and strengthen our resiliency to all kinds of threats that our national power grid has. Not only that, the fact that our grid may be linked up between North and South America. I mean, the whole continent would be linked up one day soon, it sounds like. So that was pretty interesting, I thought.
Yeah, that's both interesting and to some extent absolutely terrifying, because you know, you look at, as you mentioned on the interview with him, you look at what's happened in Venezuela, but it's not just Venezuela. You look at what was it, about 3 or 4 months ago, Argentina, Uruguay, and Paraguay had a massive outage that spanned their border region. Maybe it was a little more than that, but it was this year, and it was, again, unlike Venezuela, where it's just, you know, years of socialist hell neglect, a single plant went down, a single generating plant went down, and that sparked a cascading failure across, you know, three different countries, and left something like 10 or 15 million people without power. And so, you know, it's, if you have a completely, a hemisphere wide grid that's all interconnected, I mean, what do you have if you get, you know, again, a New York, 2003, I forget the exact year, but you know, the Northeast blackout, it just cascades there across the entire hemisphere, and the entire hemisphere goes dark, you know? So yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah. You know, and that opens things up more also, I think, for cyber attack too, and the wider threat. We had a guy talk yesterday from San Antonio. He's from CPS Energy out there, and he said that they get 3 million hits a day, cyber attacks. 3 million hits a day. That blew me away. That's just one utility. What about the rest of the utilities around the country? How many hits are they getting? And how many of them get through? You know, that's one thing guy didn't say. But, you know, at this conference, the InfraGuard National Disaster Resilience Council Summit, which is an annual event, we had industry people from both local, state, and national level. We had the regulatory bodies that the industry has for self-regulating. We had the EPRI guys there, and we had the NERC guys there. I didn't see anybody from the federal regulatory aspect, but they may have been there incognito. But we had a lot of interested people, and we had some industry insiders speaking about different things, and this gentleman was one of them who talked about the threat and why they are working with the Joint Base San Antonio to harden the grid so that they provide clean, safe power to the military operations in San Antonio that would be resilient and long-lasting so that they can perform their mission, which was fantastic, I thought, being a former San Antonian too.
Yeah, I agree. I was absolutely blown away by, you know, Fred Bonewell, the guy from CPS Energy, and then Lieutenant Colonel Eddie Stamper, the Joint Base San Antonio Electromagnetic Defense Initiative lead. And I was really, really, I mean, I was pleased to hear their presentation and to talk to them afterward, because it's really great to see that it's not like Joint Base San Antonio is driving this. It's a region wide for all of San Antonio. And of course, I think as Fred mentioned, you know, the CPS Energy is actually owned by the city of San Antonio, or it was set up by the city of San Antonio. But so it's the largest municipal utility in the U.S., I think, as I recall, he said.
Yeah, I think that's what he said. Yeah.
And, you know, it was really nice to see that it's not like, okay, it's just us, CPS Energy, and Joint Base San Antonio. It's CPS Energy, Joint Base San Antonio, and all these other stakeholders from all over San Antonio, the city government, the San Antonio Water and Sewer Authority, and all these other stakeholders. And what they're doing, they're using the Joint Base San Antonio project as not a pilot, but a proof of concept.
Yeah,
and they're
going to
take
right.
one circuit that they've identified, and they're going to harden it against physical attacks, cyber attacks, EMP, and geomagnetic disturbances. And they're going to get this one done. And then they're going to say, we've done it on a micro level with one circuit. We're going to roll this out to all of San Antonio, and we're going to make San Antonio, everything covered by CPS Energy is going to be resilient so that if everything goes down, San Antonio will survive, and it will then be kind of essentially the island generator that you can use as your spark for a black start of other grids, other
yeah.
parts of the grid.
Yeah, that was pretty cool when he mentioned that, because I hadn't heard anything like that before. I've known about this project and what they were trying to do, but that was an aspect that I hadn't learned before. And I thought that was quite commendable that was an aspect that they were looking at being, because Texas has its own grid, and the Texas grid yep. actually goes up into Oklahoma, and I'm not sure if it kind of goes into New Mexico or not. I can't remember how the picture is, but I know it goes up into Oklahoma. And so that's a portion of the country that has its own grid, and of course the eastern half of the grid is not half; it's more like 3/5 of the rest of the country, because the eastern grid is huge and it goes way over west, probably goes up. I can't remember what states are the last ones on the list there, but Arkansas and the states around there are part of the eastern grid. You know, that's significant. And any other municipality yeah. that wants to try and get involved in this, they said they will share that information and help get them going in the same direction. So any listeners out there yeah, who have any pull with your city or county or state even, and you want to get something going, just let us know and we will put you in charge or in contact with the people there in San Antonio and give you the opportunity to get things going for your local area as well.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing that Eddie Stamper said was that, you know, Texas being the way it is, there's some rivalries. So, and he's counting on this, because once San Antonio gets this stood up, they're going to turn around and Austin, which is right up the road, is going to look there and at San Antonio and go, oh, hell no, we got to do this too. And then, you know, Dallas, Fort Worth and Houston are going to do the same thing.
Oh, yeah.
And so pretty soon you've got the entire Texas grid done. And then you've got other states close by going, oh, hell no. And like Oklahoma, Texas have a huge rivalry.
Yeah.
So Oklahoma, the part, you know, they're going to go, we want in on this,
yeah.
you know, so it's a great, great approach. And it, I mean, this was, you know, I have to say, I have been to lots of professional conferences in my life. But NDRC, this ranks as probably the best professional conference I have ever attended. I mean, I don't think I have ever seen a group of people who are more passionate about building resilience securing the critical infrastructure. And I learned about so many resilience initiatives in addition to San Antonio. I mean, New Scale.
Yeah, the nuclear power reactor. Yeah.
I mean,
that's another Oregon initiative.
Yeah, and those are phenomenal, you know, and Dr. Reyes, what they're doing there, what Dr. Reyes' team is doing there is phenomenal. And then hearing General Quast, I mean, General Quast explained 5G in a way that I have never heard 5G explained before. And that really, you know, drove home what an incredible promise and opportunity 5G is, but yet also what an incredible threat it could be if it's deployed by the wrong company, if it's deployed by Huawei, because, you know, 5G, if you combine it with AI and quantum, air-gapped computers are not immune from hacking anymore with 5G and AI and quantum.
Yeah.
I mean, you can, even if they're turned off.
Yeah.
I mean,
but also you have
mind-boggling.
You have these circuits that have backdoors built into them because they were built in unsecure countries, you might say.
Exactly.
Like China. And they built everything with a backdoor. So whether they can get through it by hook or by crook, 5G gives them an easy way in. And so
absolutely.
One of the things that General Quast talked about, he's a lieutenant general, by the way, guys, he retired, but he was saying that with 5G, if you own 5G network, you own whatever that touches. That
yeah,
umbrella basically. That 5G covers is so if we go with Huawei products in the United States, like what was heading towards Europe, I mean, Europe was starting to pick up on the Huawei until President Trump told them to knock it off. I don't know if they've reversed that trend or not, but let's say Europe goes all Chinese 5G. The Chinese own everything in that region. Everything. So we can't communicate with them anymore because of the threat that the Chinese will intercept it or hack into it, or even NATO operations there. They will be able to monitor everything real time, and we wouldn't be able to do anything about it. So we would have to totally shut down NATO.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it is amazing what a threat that can be, but it's also amazing if you know that you can use it for so much good if you do it the right way. And you know, so this conference was absolutely phenomenal. And you know, I cannot say strongly enough to people who are passionate about securing critical infrastructure and particularly folks in my field in emergency management. If you are not a member of InfraGuard, you have to join and you have to go to this conference next year because this is all about resilience in so many different ways and not just resilience for the electric grid, but how can all the 16 different critical infrastructure sectors help each other. So if the grid is down, what can food do to help get the grid back up? Or if water is down, what can the grid or what can electric utilities do to help water get back up? And all this incredible intermeshing resilience is coming out of this council, and it's just amazing.
Yes. You know, one of the things that really hit home during this conference or summit was the connection and importance of the ability to communicate and get the grid started. Because the power companies, if they don't have way to communicate with their people in the field, they can't get the grid back up. So
exactly.
It's not the chicken or the egg. It's the chicken and the egg. You have to have them both up at the, you know, you have to have communication, which means you have to have some way of communicating that's you know, because they have power, it has to be able to operate. So in certain threat environments, you got to have your protected communication as well as your protected grid in order to be able to keep going. And we even heard from a guy, I think it was the first day, you may not have heard, David Winks talked about a proposal that he's working on that has the ability to withstand electromagnetic spectrum attacks and have 6 months worth of fuel that will be able to keep that thing going and possibly be a black start initiator, but on a smaller scale. So there's a lot of great stuff that came out this year, and it was really overwhelming with the amount of information and the expertise that was there. It was I was thoroughly impressed.
Yeah, I was too. And you know, I know we only have a few seconds left, but you mentioned communication and the importance to restarting the electric grid. And you know, we find that it's not just the electric grid. So, you know, every time we run an emergency management exercise, we find that almost every time, one of the top areas for improvement is communication. Now, it may not be the physical act of being able to connect to another site, although oftentimes it is. It's interoperable communications difficulties. And, you know, fire can't talk to police police can't talk to the electric company or whatever. But it's also communication between people. And communication is always the breakdown. And it not having resilient, robust, secure communication hampers everything. And so we have to keep hammering on communication and getting these avenues of communication that are secure in there so that we can do a black start, so that we can respond to, you know, whatever the incident may be.
Yes, you're right. And that ends our program for today. So civil defense equals resiliency equals survival. The top-down governmental approach to solve our community resiliency problem has failed us. We need a community-based grassroots approach to solve this problem. To be resilient, it takes preparation, organization, and training to meet the needs of whatever situation we may find ourselves in. Civil defense helps reduce panic in a disaster, and this is why we strongly recommend establishing a community-based civil defense organization in your city or county in partnership with your local community leaders and emergency manager. Let's start a conversation with the guide found on our website at civildefenseradio.com. Be sure to check out our regular postings on Facebook at Civil Defense Radio and on Twitter at @civil_def_radio, where we post things of the many threats we see to our safety and security as a nation. We want to thank Drew again, our recorded guest, Professor Adam Schultz from Oregon State University. Please be safe, be informed, and be prepared.